Phaedra Buenaderis grew up in a house where women were encouraged to design their own technology. She built computers and even her own computer games. And as she got older, she discovered the gaming world was not so inviting for women. And she wanted to change that. Phaedra and her sister founded WomenGamers.com. That was a space where women could review and discuss computer games for their own, from their own perspective. It was back in the late 90s. From there, she went on to another big venture to build games that have social impact. She became IBM's global lead for serious games and embarked on a mission to teach others how games can be used to solve complex problems and even change behavior. Today, Phaedra is a member of IBM's Academy of Technology. It's a tech design, and also is a tech design ethicist. She's working on using blockchain to democratize education. Phaedra Buenaderis, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Frank.
What is a serious game? We talked about serious games. What is that?
Serious games are when you use games to do something other than entertainment, in effect. So it can be used to teach somebody something, to help, you know, assess their skill sets, a wide spectrum of different things.
You became interested in games and you were encouraged by your family. Your mother was an engineer. Both parents were engineers, right?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. She graduated from the University of Florida in Gainesville. She was one of three women who graduated in engineering.
When was that?
Late 60s.
Okay, so that is unusual. But she also comes, your parents emigrated from Greece.
Yes.
And they came from, or your both parents came from interesting backgrounds, but your mom in particular, I would say unusual for the number of engineers and mathematicians that came out of that family among her siblings, right?
Yes, indeed. Her mother, my grandmother, had five daughters, and each of those five daughters devoted their careers towards the scientists. So we have physicists, nuclear engineers, chemists, and electrical engineers in our family.
So you were really encouraged to mess around with this kind of technology when you were young, huh?
Yes, indeed. Both of my parents worked at IBM. So at various parts of our lives, we would always have computers in different states lying around the home. And we were really encouraged. My sister and I were very encouraged to really love them and embrace them and play around with them.
Were they interesting to you?
Very much so. Very much so, yes.
How so? And what did you do with them? I mean, you imagine what you – I mean, there's one thing, you know, you sort of play with them and make little forts and houses. but you, I assume, wanted to make them into their intended purpose.
Well, we played games. Yeah. We played games. And, you know, mind you, this was early, early days, post-Pong. There was one game in particular I remember. It was inspiring to me, which is it feels kind of laughable now, but it was Colossal Cave. I don't know if you remember this. But it's fully text-based, no graphics whatsoever. You know, you say pick up glass of water, throw axe, and you're mapping out this.
But you're typing all this
world. You're typing all of this. You're typing all of this. Yes.
And were you? Did you work on projects together with your sister in order to create something, or was it just kind of?
We did. We again inspired by those early games. We wanted to design our own. So, you know, we would start off with things like pen and paper and, you know, create our own board games, but then quickly shifted to doing some really basic designs on the computer.
Meaning you're doing some programming, right?
Yes.
And this is fascinating stuff. Well, we want to find out more and how all this came together and how you ended up at IBM's Academy of Technology. My conversation is with Phaedra Buenaderis, who is a member of IBM's Academy of Technology, a serious game designer and a tech design ethicist. We'll hear more about WomenGamers.com and how that sparked Phaedra's desire to create games for good. We'll talk about that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio talking to Phaedra Buenaderis, who is tech design ethicist, a member of IBM's Academy of Technology, working to answer big questions through serious games. We talked about your upbringing, very much encouraged to play with computers. You began designing your own games with your sister. Then you run into a world where you learn, and we're talking about the late 90s now when this stuff is all taking off. And realize, or at least are told, that games, computer games, are for guys.
Yes, it was at a time where my sister and I would open up most games magazines or look at most gaming websites, and they weren't targeting us at all. And we recognized that we really wanted to give women a voice within that market. So we decided to start a company called WomenGamers.com. And it was a portal that was really dedicated towards this effort. So we would review games. We would write articles about how women were depicted in games. We wrote about women who worked within the industry. And when we first started, it was really difficult to get game publishers to send us their games for review. Really, really difficult. And it wasn't until we got an op-ed piece in Entertainment Weekly and they showcased us that suddenly it opened up the doors.
What kind of reactions were you getting, though? I imagine you were getting some negative reactions about women sort of entering this space, right?
It was both positive as well as negative. With regards to the negative, it's true that we did receive emails that would say, oh, you know, women aren't interested in playing games. Women don't play games, you know, the fake news of that time, right?
Right.
But
because they were even then. I mean, that's part of it. It wasn't like you're opening up the world. The world had, I mean, it may not have been parody, but the women were playing.
Oh,
more.
Indeed, of course. And but at the same time, in parallel, when my sister and I would go to games conferences, big ones like E3 or the Game Developers Conference, when women would see our badges and they knew what we represented, they would come up and give us hugs. We couldn't believe it. Absolutely couldn't believe it. So we really heard from a lot of women who either worked in the games industry or were really passionate about games who were grateful to have us as a voice for them.
So it's one thing to say, look, gain access to this industry, understand that we're really out there playing these games. You know, this is fake news that we're not. What about some of the other questions that arose that you say you addressed? For instance, how women were depicted in some of those earlier games, and I guess still are.
Yeah, I mean, we would review all kinds of different games. Sometimes, you know, we would talk about how women were depicted in those games, or whether there was even things like women being raped within those games. So we saw a wide spectrum of different things, and we really wanted to call them out and say, you know, there's actually this market of people who want to play games like this. Please do consider them as part of your audience.
At this point, what is your? Do you have any sense of your career track, where you're headed?
Well, at the time, I would say this was now early 2000s. Actually, it was an NPR reporter, Laura Seidel, who mm-hmm. covers technology. She reached out to me and she wanted to do a piece with me at the Electronic Entertainment Expo E3 about women in games. So she and I decided to walk the halls that year of the conference, and it was the year that Nintendo came out with a Wii. And suddenly, all the marketing really, really changed. Instead of seeing just young males, pictures of young males being depicted playing games, you saw women, you saw other adults, you saw families playing. So there was a big shift in the market, and it really made me consider going back and getting my MBA so I could learn more about finance, accounting, and possibly opening up a studio.
Because you had done your undergrad at UNC Chapel Hill, right?
Correct.
And what was your plan there?
After undergrad?
Well, yeah, and for undergrad as you're going through, or were you
the
rest of us and said, I just need to get through this and figure it out?
At the time, when I was ready for undergrad, there were no such thing as game design and development degree programs as there are now. So in fact, when we were up and running with Women Gamers, one of the pieces of feedback we received from people was, if you really have an issue with the way that women are being depicted in games, maybe more women should be designers. Maybe more women should be designing and developing these games, which I thought was a fair point. So we started a scholarship program for the first one in the U.S. for women to pursue degrees in game design and development. Because, again, that's something that we recognized we really wanted to address.
So you said, and then as a result of this piece, you began to think more deeply about the openings, the possibility of opening for more women, and you go back and get your MBA. Talk about that, because at that point, while you're going to school, you're going to Kenan Flagler at the time, IBM comes to Kenan Flagler with a challenge, right?
Correct. I had thrown myself into these things called case competitions, which is when a business will go to a business school with a real life challenge. And frequently the students have only overnight to come up with a solution that they then pitch the next day. And I was on my sixth competition. It was sponsored by IBM, and it was a contest between UNC and Duke. And the challenge that IBM had was that they had business process management software, and they were looking for innovative ways of explaining it to non-techies. And at the time, I had no idea what business process management was. But they handed—
Because you were a techie.
I was a techie. I still didn't know what business process management was. Right. But they handed each team a stack of papers about 3 inches thick, and they said, go read this. And maybe it's because of what I was playing at the time, but as I was reading it, I was thinking, oh, you know, this is a strategy game, or maybe like a sim-style game where I can tweak different business rules, seeing how it affects the broader process. I could have competing models, collaborate around a model. And so that's what had popped in my mind at the time.
So you saw it as a game.
I did. Right. I did.
Because games... remember now, IBM goes to a business school. This is not, we're talking to somebody who is deep in technology. We're going to, and we've already, you know, signaled the fact that you're into AI. But IBM doesn't, they've gone to a business school to say, how do we get this process management taught to people? Because we're about technology, but we want project managers who may or may not know about the technology, but they have to know timelines. How do we bring these worlds together? They go to the business school and they find somebody with a technological mind who says, I think there's a computer game in this.
Yeah. Well, I think it is, the reason why I jumped there is because games can be really adept at explaining complex systems, if you think about it, whether it's, you know, very sophisticated supply chains or logistics or process optimization. I mean, they can be really adept at it, of explaining it simply. So within 3 seconds, you know what's going on in your world and how things are moving around. So I think that's
well, and the way you think about the problem. I mean, I think that's the other thing. That's what's happening in a game, right? You're given an objective and a set of rules, and now you're trying to get your piece across the board. And it's different than saying, what's the best way to plan a timeline on a multifaceted project with, you know, several clients? So what's the reaction to this? Because I understand that not everybody on your team in school thought that you had such a great idea.
This is true. There was someone on my team who we actually ended up arguing till about 2 a.m. he said, you know, games are for kids. IBM is too conservative of a company. And I argued. And he ended up leaving the team. So he abandoned us. And then the rest of us ended up presenting the idea the next morning.
So you're a pretty persuasive arguer, or at least you had more coffee or something. And it turns out that wins the day, because tell us about IBM's reaction to this.
Yeah, so the next morning, unbeknownst to me, one of the VPs for IBM was a judge, and she funded it on the spot. She said, you know, will you make this game for me in 3 months? And at the time, I thought, oh my gosh, it could take years to develop a really good video game. And she says, oh, you know what? I'm just looking for a proof of concept to see if you can even use a video game to help explain something like this to people. And so while I was getting my MBA, I started interning at IBM, helping to design and craft this game. And I was really lucky because I ended up working with an incredible team, both within IBM as well as a local studio to get the first it was the first of a series of games developed.
And was there the same? It's interesting. You said the judge, she. I don't know if there's anything about that particular gender relationship, the idea that it was a woman who saw the wisdom of this particular idea of yours. Was it difficult to work with that team or find a team who also saw that this may be the path?
You know what? This particular judge, this vice president, really went out on a limb for me. Because, mind you, this was back, you know, in 2007, 2008. And the word game in a big corporation can oftentimes, at least at that time, was certainly a dirty word. Yeah. You know, this was well before gamification really ended up being this big thing. And so she certainly did take a risk for me.
And in some ways, your dissident teammate who left the group was kind of right. I mean, you know, that she was an outlier in that way. But you developed this game, and it was pretty impressive. They liked what they saw.
They did. They did. We actually ended up releasing it for free via IBM's Academic Initiative, which is a free program for schools to sign up and get access. And in 6 months, we had over 1,000 universities downloading and using that game, many of which started to use it to teach business process management as part of their core curriculum.
And it drew the attention of the Defense Department.
Yes. The next in the series of games started to include scenarios like smarter cities, supply chain optimization, these kinds of things. And indeed, there was an agency within the Defense Department, the United States Transportation Command, which invited me to go and present at one of their enterprise architecture summits.
And talk about that and a little bit about what it involved. You talk about supply chain, but again, you're trying to look at some of the nuts and bolts management questions that any big organization faces. And of course, they have a mission as well. In this case, the Defense Department, technology when it comes to IBM. Who was it that thought the games would be a good idea at the Defense Department? And was that a hard sell for them?
So United States Transportation Command, they manage the logistics across all the branches of the military. So when there is an event or disaster, let's say in Haiti, they've got to get the right stuff to the right place at the right time at the right cost whilst working with all these different groups. And so this summit was being sponsored by the four-star general who runs U.S. Transcom. And right before I got up to present, this four-star gets up and he shows a timeline. And he says, look at what has happened around the world in the last 9 months that we've had to respond to. And he lists off, you know, the tsunami, the earthquake in Haiti, tsunami in Japan, the volcano going off in Iceland, all these different war fronts. And he says, how can we as an organization have ever been able to be prepared for even a subset of things on this list, much less all of them in a 9-month space? But he says, also even more importantly, how are we supposed to have been able to psychologically vet and get buy-in on these best practices with all these different groups we need to work with? And he said, it's for this reason that we're looking in towards advanced serious games as a mechanism to do this. And so he handed the podium over to me, and I talked about the fact that games can be incredibly adept at explaining complex systems. I showed them the logistics games for process change. But then I said, you know, we're at a unique point in time where we can integrate real data and real processes within very sophisticated games engines. And because of that, we could start to create games for strategic execution and tactical operations, not just teaching somebody something, but actually helping to optimize a process or creating a dynamic best practice playbook. And so the four-star pulled me aside and said, hey, you know, are you available a month from now? You know, come back and I'd like for you to come and present. And as an aside, at this point, I was 7 months pregnant. So he's like, what are you doing a month from now? We'd like you to come and present to DARPA. And
DARPA is his transport.
The advanced research for the Department of Defense. And he said, we'd like for you to invite anyone you want from the games industry to make that vision a reality. So if we were to create, for example, a disaster preparedness or disaster response game for Haiti, invite whom you want to make that vision a reality if it were to include real data and real processes. So I was racking my brain. Who do I invite? Who do I invite? And I remember that there was a person who had presented at the Game Developers Conference a year prior, and he's local. His name is Dr. Chris Hazard. And he had created this incredible game and game engine that allows individuals to jump around time and change their decisions. And basically, the reason why I invited him was I couldn't think, if you had to figure out a way in a multiplayer environment to optimize a process, the being able to change your decisions over time on a granular level would be imperative. Right.
So is this you take it on a timeline? This is what your investment advisor does, right? They got 1,000 little threads between you and decrepitude, and what they say is, you know, the market, and there's literally like 1,000. I saw this thing recently. I still don't understand it. I just hope I'm okay. But enough about me. But the idea is that you thread out all these possibilities and then imagine, okay, if this, but you're doing it in this sort of incredible amount of time that the computer can do this, to see what you might do. If this happened, if that happened, if this happened. Is this the idea?
Precisely
that,
right.
Over time.
But highly graphical.
Yeah,
so as an example, the way I've heard Chris describe it to me or to others is, if you remember the movie Back to the Future, the scene where McFly is holding up a Polaroid picture, but because of something he did in the past, he's slowly fading. His game engine works the same way. So I can move backwards in time, change a decision, and that timeline will propagate to other players' presence. And so, you'll see, you know, shifting ports of entry. You'll see shifting supply chains just because of changes in decisions happening in the past. So we went and both presented at that DARPA summit. And then I was invited to go and present 2 weeks later at the Pentagon. So that was wonderful. Again, speaking about how is it that you can use games of this nature with this kind of data and AI capabilities as a mechanism to solve problems.
I thought that meeting at the Pentagon was dramatic, was it not?
It was, because at this time I was 8.5 months pregnant. <Right. laughs> So I was too far gone to get on a plane by that point. So my family and I trucked up on a train. And the day we were to present was the day that the sniper was shooting at the Pentagon. So, you know, there are a lot of soldiers and a lot of yelling outside. And by the time I managed to get through security into the lobby, I distinctly remember, you know, sitting on one of the benches and turning to the person next to me who was, you know, in full military gear and saying, you know, I think I'm having contractions. And he said, I am too. This place does it to everyone.
I see. So we'll all survive that. It's fascinating. And to think about using real-time data, too, that these games are not static games. And you survived, and the pregnancy went well.
Yes, it did. Thank you for asking.
I'm glad to hear that. Also, students, you had – we're going to start this story now, and perhaps we're going to have to continue later, but I want you to talk a little bit about your work with students, too, because this is not just a military operation.
Not at all. In fact, due to the interest from the Defense Department, I was asked to incubate an advanced serious games program within our consulting division and started working with different industries. Began to write a lot about the use of games as a means to solve problems. And it got the attention of a very special teacher out in Texas. And this teacher reached out to me. He had used some of my games in his class. And he reached out and said, you know, I'm teaching computer science, but the way that I'm teaching it is through serious game design. And he said, this semester, I've got the Center for Disease Control who's sponsoring the theme for my class. And the theme is that they want our students to design a video game that will teach other kids about pathogens and pandemics. So he said, so my kids have reskinned Minecraft such that you can fly a nanobot through a human body. And when the nanobot meets with a pathogen, we want to actually be able to communicate with an AI that's been trained in pathogens so we can ask questions from within the game.
When a nanobite meets a pathogen. Next on The State of Things, Phaedra Boinodiris, a member of IBM's Academy of Technology. My conversation continues after this. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio talking with Phaedra Boinodiris, a member of IBM's Academy of Technology. She designs serious games that tackle big questions about ethics and AI. And before we get into the ethics of AI, we want to talk more about serious gaming, which a teacher from Texas reaches out to you. He's got a project going with NIH. He's got students designing a game that sends nanobots into humans to find pathogens and then communicate with them. And that's what you know, and you enter the story there. Tell us more.
Yes, they wanted to be able to communicate with an AI that had been trained, and that is IBM's Watson. And immediately I was intrigued by his story, absolutely intrigued. And the more and more that I learned about his classroom and the school, the more intrigued I was, because this was not a fancy schmancy school. This was an at-risk school in Texas, a school for disadvantaged kids. And so this teacher, his name's David Conover, he was teaching using a very entrepreneurial way of approaching the classroom, where there would be a rotating leadership model and the kids would come up with their own business plans.
And what age level?
This is high school.
Okay.
High school, so 9th through 12th grade. And so I was intrigued, and I immediately asked for volunteers within IBM to help. And Joe Kozaya and Srinivas Chimalapati both raised their hands, big medical Minecraft fans, or rather Minecraft fans. And we started working together with this class. And I remember one of the girls in the class, I think she must have been in 9th grade. I was asking her, so, you know, tell me what inspires you so much about this class. And she said, you know, my dad has been deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan on multiple tours of duty, and he really suffers from PTSD. And the only thing that helps him best manage his stress is playing video games. So she says, I really want to devote my career towards understanding games for health, games for mental health in particular. So, again, I'm over the moon inspired by this class. And I convinced IBM's PR and comms department to fly a TV crew out with me to film a documentary of the class, which was absolutely an amazing experience.
So tell me more about the process, because, again, and you talked about this with the logistics stuff with DOD. The idea of including real-time data is critical to all this. It's one thing to learn a process through a game, but another to actually solve problems. You need the data. And this teacher reaches out to you and said, you know, if I had Watson, we have a lot of stuff to play with. But the kids as well, I mean, talking to kids, high school students, the fact that they have the imagination to do this, and again, the incentive to do this, right, that they wanted to do it, and it also points back to what you were doing with the Defense Department, a realization that people on the ground, that the rank and file might have a lot of answers. How do we gather the data from all of those informants out there in real time and in a timely way? And games can do that. And now you're working with these kids. So what did you learn? And talk more about that project.
Well, what I learned was when we came out to film the class, the documentary, it's just 3 minutes long. It's really short, but it really went viral. And the next thing we knew is that the teacher and I were asked to go and present about this project to educational summits all over. And then shortly thereafter, he was recognized by the Obama administration as being a champion for change for education, which I thought was tremendous. But about 2 weeks later, the same teacher reached out to me and he said, you know, Phaedra, I think I'm going to lose my job. And I said, what? What are you talking about? Like, you just went out to the White House. How is this possible? Yeah. And he says, you know, my principal doesn't understand how to measure success in a classroom like mine. Mm. How do you measure success? I'm not teaching towards any standardized test. I've got a very entrepreneurial model. They don't understand what to do with a teacher like me. And so I convinced him to go and have breakfast with the superintendent. And when he went out to breakfast with the superintendent, I told him, you know, you should tell him not just that you're working with us, but he was working, as I said, with the Center for Disease Control. He was talking to NASA. He was talking to Microsoft, all these different groups. And the result of that breakfast was that the next thing I knew, this army from Texas flies out here to RTP, North Carolina, to do a design thinking session about cultural transformation within not just classrooms, but school systems, because the superintendent recognized, I've got to figure out how to give not just you air cover, but how to spread the seeds of what you've started here across my school district. And so I took them all to the Hunt Library. I took them to makerspaces around campus at, you know, UNC. And what I really wanted to impress upon them was that truly we are at the cusp of a technology tsunami in the form of artificial intelligence and robotics and automation. And that not only do we need to reconsider the kinds of things that we're teaching, but also the way that we're teaching.
Because his worry about teaching to the test was the big problem, right? I mean, that
precisely.
Was all of these standardized tests that were missing all of this energy, and that's what's going on. So how do you feel about that? I mean, in terms of education today, this wasn't just his class and saving one job. This is, I think maybe you were just getting to that. The way we're teaching could be have to go out the window, or at least be revolutionized to include a little bit more of this, huh?
Right, exactly. In fact, it... one of the things that it led me to understand was this tremendous need for a mindset shift instead of, you know, school-centered education to really shift towards being learner-centered. And the more and more that I studied not just his class but learned about other classrooms, other school systems, other countries that are trying to embrace this kind of mindset shift, I really began to see a pattern of sorts emerge.
Well, talk more about that pattern and what you're seeing. Are you seeing that this change is taking place?
In some countries, yes. Yeah. In some school districts, yes. For example, not having any standardized tests in countries like Finland, right?
Because all of that speaks to, and again, you get to the real revolution and your insight into how these games could be real-time games, whether it's about teaching business practices or logistics. That is to say, rather than see school as a place where we practice and fill our heads with stuff, why not get engaged in the problem using real-time data? It's all out there. And in that engagement process, we're not only learning, but we're contributing at the same time. And why don't we let the product be the score here? If we're turning something out, it's good. And not necessarily penalize failure, because that's part of success, right?
Precisely.
You've
got
to fail
right.
Quite a bit before you can actually get to the winner.
Precisely right. And I think you touched on something really important, which is that the social impact piece is in particular important. It's not for this class in particular, what was driving many of the students was, I want to design a game which is going to solve a problem in my community, in my family, right? Per that one girl I mentioned earlier. So that was something that class certainly taught me.
Yeah, and think about what we're teaching. I mean, again, it gets back to what you just said. If I'm teaching you to get a good grade on a test, then the motive here is me. The motive is my grade. But these children and all of us are so full of a desire to make the world a better place. Why not unleash that and
right.
be the measure of our success?
Exactly right. Exactly right. And I continue to be inspired by this class. In fact, they're working on two projects right now. One is they're creating a disaster response game using blockchain, which I think is totally cool. And then the second one they're doing is they were given the task to come up with a smart toy that uses an old toy to solve a problem. So I don't know, for those listeners on the show who remember Hungry Hungry Hippos, that you're like pressing the lever and you're getting your hippo to eat the marbles. Well, they took that toy and they bought a used brainwave monitoring device off of eBay and hooked Arduinos up to the hippos such that without your hands, the way that you win the game and get your hippo to eat the marbles is by going into a semi-meditative state. So you actually have to change your brainwave pattern, lower your heart rate, calm yourself down. And that's how you win the game.
You have attached brainwave mechanism to Hungry Hungry Hippos, and you're actually thinking. But this is so important. But let's reinforce this now. The point was, go into a meditative state.
Yes.
And that's what gets them to.
Well, I asked the kids, so tell me, what's the purpose of this? And they said, quite simply and eloquently, we are training Jedi, We are training Jedi, and they're playtesting this to kids going through chemotherapy at the Dell Children's Hospital. So kids going through chemo, obviously under tremendous amount of duress and stress and pain, and yet here's this toy built by other kids to help them with their stress.
So they came up with the idea, and then they designed it, and then they made it. And it's Hungry, Hungry Hippos, which now I will never...
Stage two.
Blockchain. Tell us more about that. You have to tell us what it is and how this has a real social impact implication.
Okay. So how I stumbled upon blockchain, because it wasn't really in my sphere at the time, was that through this experience with medical Minecraft and thinking about the culture change that is desperately needed within not just classrooms but within school systems, I began to think, is it possible that our public school system will not be able to be agile and adaptable enough to get in front of this technology tsunami? And if it isn't, is there a way in which we can make use of a much broader ecosystem, open up such that students would be able to get credit from things they learn, both from formal as well as informal learning settings? So if you have someone taking a course online because they don't have access to a robotics teacher or an AI teacher or a computer science teacher within their school, how do we get that person credit? Same thing with after-school programs, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts. Like, is there a way? Is there a way? And that's when I was introduced to this concept of blockchain and its ability to be able to authenticate and ensure that when you've gone and proven that you've learned something, that that record goes on something that is decentralized.
Yeah, and blockchain is what is used in cryptocurrencies, for instance.
Correct.
So Bitcoin is based on this authentication process. That's an anonymous process. This would not be.
That's right. This would be for permission blockchain. So you're absolutely right. So cryptocurrency was built on anonymous blockchains in order to keep track of the movement of currency and your trading data associated with that. In permissioned blockchains, there's actually a network and a governance model and a set of rules. So in this case, with micro-credentialing, you can have a student that says, okay, you know, I've learned this in robotics camp. I took this course online. I took these three courses from my community college. I took these two courses from Harvard, one from UNC Chapel Hill. It is on my decentralized ledger, so I don't have to go to any single institution to get a transcript. And furthermore, as a student, I have control over who gets to see it and for what purpose. And so that data control is now in the hands of that individual.
And that cracks the nut that we run into when we hear about teaching to the test. And somebody says, well, how are we going to know these kids achieved anything? And so they come up with a standardized test that tells you they know how to take a test and their teachers know how to coach them into a test. So that's what you learned when they finish that test. So this is a way to answer that and say, we think we have a way,
right,
a means of testing all of the other kinds of knowledge and database that young people can bring to the project.
That's the idea. And I think for me, what's most exciting about this is the idea of how do we democratize education? So irrespective of the geography that you're growing up in, and again, thinking about the technology tsunami and our desperate need to reskill workers, we're going to have to train people to do completely different things. Are we really going to be burdening our public school system to be able to do all this? How do we open this?
Well, the other answer to that is we don't. We don't bother. We let the machines do it because they're learning. And through AI, they'll just take over and we can sit back and I'm not sure.
Bonbons?
I don't know what we're going to be doing when they take over everything. But what about that? Because I know you have some concerns about AI, too. It's not all upside, certainly, when it comes to technology.
Well, there are a lot of questions about data privacy, but also how AI is trained. So, you know, two different issues here. One thing that concerns me is that for whatever reason, people think that because it's artificial intelligence, that somehow morally and ethically it's squeaky clean because it's not a human. Whereas, in fact, you know, it takes people choosing data sets to train that artificial intelligence. And so oftentimes, we've seen examples of AI that can be incredibly biased. So
there's a ProPublica piece, right? Tell us about that one. That was interesting, that research.
A few years ago, ProPublica came out with an expose. There was an app that was being used by the judicial system, by judges, to help determine the level of recidivism of people that were up for parole. Mm-hmm. Like, what were the chances? What are the chances that this parolee A versus parolee B is going to go and commit another crime? And ProPublica came out with a report, and all of this is available publicly. They came out with a report saying this is racist, true blue racist. So it was just
was built into the numbers.
It was built in. Right. It was built in. So it's it is frightening to see. And one of the things I really want to raise the awareness of is, you know, how AI is being trained, and that there is the ability for technologies to be used to keep that checked and balanced.
Depending on who programmed that check and balance.
But also, there's, for example, OpenScale AI, which is a product that flags when bias is happening within AI. But then there's other open source projects such that, you know how I talked about micro-credentialing and blockchain? We can do the same thing with AI, so that as you're training an AI and introducing new patterns to that AI, that should be logged in a blockchain too, to enforce transparency. Let me see how this AI was trained. And in fact, there was a project that I did at the Marbles Museum in Raleigh that helped to underscore this issue or this challenge.
All right, Phaedra, I'm slightly more optimistic than I was an hour ago.
Yes.
Phaedra Boinodiris is a member of IBM's Academy of Technology, serious game designer, and a tech design ethicist. Thank you so much for being on our program.
My pleasure.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.